Okay, everybody's here, so the committee will come to order. So, the world belongs to those who show up, right? Good morning, members. I've got a bill hearing up right now in another committee, so I'm going to scoot to go present my bill. I've asked our vice chair to preside over the hearing. I'll be back a little bit later. Today we're going to be hearing on early childhood issues. It's my intent that the deeper discussions around early childhood issues will, both policy and finance, will be delved into in the early childhood finance division. But we are the E12 committee, and so I want to make sure that we have ownership over those early childhood issues, and we certainly will be hearing policy bills related to early childhood. My interest this year in this regard is to have us focus primarily, not exclusively, but primarily on the linkages between early childhood and K-12, and to look at bills and spend time talking about how the two parts of that educational pathway connect with one another and reinforce one another, and obviously focus on school readiness issues to a large degree. And so to sort of warm us up get our heads around that, I've asked a few presenters to come. We've asked the department to come and share a broad outline of early childhood work and responsibilities that they have. I've also asked the Ready for K folks to come and share with us very broadly their agenda for this year, in particular to focus, help us focus on this issue of early childhood and K-12 linkages. So I hope that, you know, this is really an informational hearing, and I hope that we'll be able to have a really good discussion this morning. I'll be back for hopefully the bulk of that discussion a little bit later. But at this point, I'll ask Representative Dietrich to take over the meeting. We'll see you in a few minutes.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. We have a quorum here, so I am going, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for Thursday, January 25th and Tuesday, January 30th. Representative Gottwald.
Madam Vice Chair, so moved.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for January 25th and January 30th are approved. Today there are a couple of announcements that I want to make, and first of all is that we're going to continue the rich tradition of Representative Mariani, and we are going to continue with our introductions. And I have chosen two that I believe have not been introduced yet, but I want to just give you a little bit of a heads up. That would be Representative Peterson and Representative Wardlow, I believe, have not introduced themselves and their districts to the committee yet. And so I will call on them in just a few minutes. But in the meantime, while they're gathering their thoughts, I would like to take note of two handouts in your folders. They were from Tuesday night's hearing, and they did not get distributed. The first is a pamphlet on the Minneapolis IB program, and I would like members just to take a look at that. When I looked at that, I thought of one of the testifiers that night who talked about one of his dreams for the Minneapolis School District was to start communicating with parents in language that parents could understand. And I took one look at that handout, and I thought, they've heard that message, and they are definitely trying to communicate with parents in language that parents can understand. And the other thing you have here is a letter regarding the five-year limit on funding for ELL. So I just wanted to make note of those two handouts. So I would call on Representative Peterson. Would you please introduce yourself to the committee and your district? Would you?
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. My name is Sandra Peterson, and I also am a teacher, as are many of the folks sitting around this table. I worked in early childhood, K-12, and at the high school level, most of my years at the high school level, but certainly enjoyed all of the levels of education that I worked in. And our district, the district I represent is Robbinsville, which encompasses seven cities and is one of the larger districts in the state, but is one of the first-ring suburbs becoming more urban than suburban, actually. We're struggling, as many of the districts are, with the issues of mobility, changing, more diverse population, and the need to find ways to help our parents really find programs that they find challenging and acceptable, because if parents aren't pleased with the programs, they tend to walk with their feet to the West. And so we're finding that some programs like Spanish immersion, which starts in the kindergarten, has waiting lists of parents who want to enroll. And that those are the kinds of programs, along with the middle school IB program, which keeps students in their schools. They provide more stable programs. They don't move. Even if they should move their homes, they still come back to that particular school. So we're finding the need to inform parents and find programs that they will find acceptable. Certainly, we deal with all the issues of language, the English language learners, the standards, how do we get kids ready for the standards, and finding ways to assure that our students can meet the increasing AYP standards for achievement and not be considered one of those failing schools. Because it's amazing, the parents do look at those stars, and they make some decisions sometimes based on those stars. So I think we're similar to many of the first-ring suburbs with many of the same problems that we heard the other night in North Minneapolis. The kinds of issues that they have sounded very, very familiar. And so I think with that, that's enough information. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Would you also just highlight some of your experience with early education?
I've told this story before. I was licensed in early childhood education and in special education, and I spent one summer in a practicum actually working with 3- and 4-year-old special needs students. And I have told everyone it was the hardest thing I've ever done. And I wasn't sure that I would have the patience to do it for a whole career, because it was very demanding, very challenging, also very rewarding. And it certainly gave me a foundation for my belief that we must deal with children at an early age and prepare them and get them ready for kindergarten. And, of course, I'd go back as the Mel Foundation is with even birth, and helping them from the time they leave the hospital, and then helping them once they get to be 3- or 4-year-olds, getting them into licensed kinds of situations where they have the kind of programs that will help them to be ready for school. And then having taught in the kindergarten for several years, I also saw the needs of children coming in at that age, and those who were ready, and they were ready to soar, and those who had a very limited kind of background and required a lot of remediation.
Yes, thank you so much, Representative Peterson. Representative Ordloff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really had a lot to say, you know, like 3 weeks ago, but I forgot now. I'm Lynn Wardlow, and this is my third term, and I taught mathematics for 31 years and a third, mostly middle school, most recently in high school. I also coached football and wrestling that whole time. My wife's a third grade teacher in Lakeville. Everybody I know in my family, almost, both sides, hers and mine, are either teachers or farmers, so I'm also a retired Marine reservist. After 4 years and a tour in Vietnam, I wanted to stay in, but my wife didn't, so we didn't, and I became a teacher. But I firmly believe the more I visit the child centers and talk to people, early childhood is a key element, especially for those who the parents can't be home. The children need to be hugged and kissed and looked in the eye, and you point them to the shiny things when they want to look at them, and you point them to the rough things on the floor when they want to play on the floor. That's how their brain develops, and so we got to take care of those early childhood little ones, especially those who don't have parents who can stay home with them because they're the single parent situation. But I'll just say one thing that nobody else has said, instead of boring you with all my beliefs and everything, I can't solve it by myself anyway. I had a student teacher once, it was her second career, and they gave her to me because I was older than everybody else, and so they let me have this person. And she went to the University of Minnesota, and it was an eighth grade mathematics class, and she was one of those types that just took charge. And when she actually became my principal eventually, but that tells you something, doesn't it? But she said they had to film the class, and then they had to show it to all the student teachers back at the U. And the professor, you know, they showed our class, and the people were saying, well, why is that kid standing up? Why is that kid, why aren't they, why do they move so much? This is eighth grade class. And the teacher said, or the professor said, just mark your words, all you people who are student teaching in the high schools, watch, because this is a middle school. And furthermore, if you teachers in the high school pass, you have to pass, if you want to pass this course, you better pass with a good grade in the middle, in your student teaching. You people in the middle school, if you just survive with a marginal, you're going to pass, because if you can survive middle school, you can survive anything. Although I could never go back and teach third grade because I... You have to move too much for those kids. So. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wardlow. When you said that you had been a math teacher for that many years, my mind immediately went to my kitchen table last night at 10 o'clock and trying to help my senior with his math. We're trying to isolate why. I thought, boy, I wish you were at my house last night. Okay. Thank you very much. We will go ahead and get started. As the E-12 Education Policy Committee, today is our first opportunity to look at issues related to early childhood education. We will hear a brief overview of early education programs from the governor's budget proposals and from Commissioner Segrin, department staff, followed by an overview of issues related to kindergarten readiness from Ready 4K. And we also have added onto the agenda Dr. Karen Ephraim, policy analyst and board member from EdWatch. And we will proceed today by calling the first testifiers up to the table. And after they are done, we will ask questions. So please save your questions until after each testifier is done. But we will take a few minutes after each testifier to ask questions. So at this time, I would like to call Commissioner Alice Segrin and Karen Carlson, Director of Early Learning Services from the Department of Education, forward. Good morning and welcome. Commissioner, I believe you are going to start.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you. And good morning on this very cold morning. We are happy to present this morning the governor's recommendations for early childhood. And if you want to follow along in your budget change items, you can do so if you have those in your packet. And I'll give you the page numbers if you happen to have that information with you. The first thing that we're going to talk about is the governor's early childhood scholarships, and that is found on page 260 of your budget change item pages. This is really the centerpiece of the governor's early childhood proposal. And his focus this year is on at-risk children. We have had 3 years of study, the department has, on kindergarten readiness. And as you analyze that, those studies, that 3 years of study, you will find a consistency there in the areas of early childhood literacy and mathematical preparation. We find that when you analyze the data, there are about between 11 to 12% of students that are not yet ready. In other words, do not have any of the indicators that they would be prepared at all for kindergarten. Many of the children are in progress, and developmentally, certainly we know that 3- and 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds actually have many developmental acceleration points, plateaus, etc. So everyone develops differently at those very early ages. But we do know, and we want to focus on those students that have no indicators at all as they're preparing to go into school. And that is what the governor is focusing on. And then when you dig down into the analysis of kindergarten and you look at all of the other indicators, such as behavioral issues, emotional or social emotional development, most of those are fine. The kids are doing well. But again, what we find is where they're lagging behind is in their literacy skills, their phonemic awareness, their mathematical concepts of oneness, etc., are really where the problem areas are. The scholarship program was established, and it will be used for children who qualify for free and reduced lunch for the year prior to kindergarten. And the scholarships will be for up to $4,000 per child, and a scholarship could be used for any private or public early childhood program. A certificate of eligibility will be given to the parent and who chooses a program from a list of approved providers that the MDE department will provide. The funds will go to those programs, and the department will create a list based on the kind of instruction that could be provided to these children. So we want to make sure that these programs have an educational component in them so that those students who are identified at risk will have that support. The first year of the biennium, we will work with programs to apply and receive approval, and then the next year of the biennium is where we'll really ramp up the scholarship program. We anticipate that about 7,000 scholarships will be given, and the cost in the first year, because this is the first transition year, if you will, or our preparation year, would be about $400,000. And the cost for the year when it's actually implemented is about $28.5 million. Now, the next area that the governor has made some proposals for is in early childhood family education. As you know, that has really been a unique and wonderful program that the state of Minnesota created a number of years ago. But it hasn't received a lot of attention in the last few years in regard to results, accountability. Is it really fulfilling its mission that it was created for? And so we want to make sure that just like in Head Start and our school readiness programs, there's also some accountability measures available for legislators to examine, for the public to examine, for parents to participate in it, can examine so that there's an assurance that they are meeting their mission. So we want to make sure that they also, the CFE providers, submit a plan or application prior to funding approval. Head Start and also any of our school readiness programs do have to submit that kind of a plan. We want to make sure that the program is meeting its objectives and that the services are being provided. We want to make sure that the program components are clarified, particularly to ensure that the families and communities that want to participate are participating. And sometimes, and I think this has, and I think many people, I've made this comment before, that a lot of times the ECFE programs are being attended by families that are more upper middle class, and that's wonderful. I mean, that's not bad. But a lot of times families who live in communities feel a little bit uncomfortable if they're a lower income families and have not been really made welcome, but there's some discomfort, and we want to make sure that we're reaching out to all families, and I think that that is something that we need to work on in the ECFE area. We want to make sure that all families are being reached, so we want to particularly focus on that. Beginning in by actually 2011, a district, we want to make sure that this is a transition process. We want to make sure that a district is having on file an approved plan, but we want to have a transition period for that. But after that, a district cannot certify an ECFE program if they don't have a plan on file that's approved. The proposal also limits equipment expenditures to 10% of the total program revenue, and that's very consistent with our other community education programs, not Head Start, but community ed programs. The cost for the first year is $211,000, and then the base year after the startup is about $196,000. The next area that the governor has focused on is an early childhood teacher training. And this is an idea that would help those child care providers or others that are working with young children have an opportunity to receive some training in the observation of childhood behavior, the assessing of a child's progress, and then communicating this to parents, and helping plan curriculum and activities and instruction based on a child's assessment. These early childhood offerings are a combination of public and private programs, and many times they have varying staff requirements. Sometimes you might have a licensed teacher, but most of the time there is no licensed individual that has that kind of skill or training. Currently, licensure, in fact, is not required for teachers in Head Start or school readiness programs, and only teachers in early childhood family education actually have a licensure. So this proposal is to bring targeted training, and it's sort of a train-the-trainer model where we would go out and train staff in these observational techniques so that they can work effectively with their children. And it would be on an ongoing basis throughout the state. The training could be actually accessed on the web, or, as I said, it would be a train-the-trainer model. The cost for the first year to actually develop the curriculum and the observational techniques, et cetera, would be about $154,000. And then after that, the base would be about $70,000 per year. The last area that we want to address is in school readiness improvement, and that goal is to improve the educational offerings that are actually in all of our Head Start, school readiness, and the other kind of child care programs. The governor had a summit on school readiness back in the summer, and there were 10 elements that were suggested that we try to cover as we're looking at early childhood readiness. Three of these the governor has chosen to focus on this biennium, and those are compensatory services, in other words, instruction that accelerates literacy and language development and mathematical thinking, instructional content and activities that are of sufficient strength sufficient length and intensity, and then highly trained professionals. So he's chosen those three and trying to build capacity in those areas. So what we're proposing to do right now, there are many ECFE licensed providers and ECFE programs However, a lot of times they only work half-time or part-time. And we would propose to allow for some contracting of their services to actually go into some of our Head Start programs or school readiness programs to also go in and provide really in-depth educational experiences for children in the areas of literacy and mathematics. And they would actually then work in conjunction with what we were previously talking about, kind of the trained staff that are looking at the observational sets of, you know, assessing, et cetera, and kind of working alongside each other. They would, you know, provide some mentoring, et cetera, but also the actual instruction. This was something that was explored with, I think, through the Early Childhood Caucus, and Oklahoma has used this method in their programs and found this to be very successful. School districts would apply for funds to send licensed early childhood teachers into the Head Starts or school readiness and child care programs, and it would be for at least 3 hours a day for 4 days per week. And the cost each year for this proposal would be $4.1 million. The last thing that I wanted to bring up, and it isn't in your early childhood section, but it is a proposal through Serve Minnesota. As you all know, or you may not know, Serve Minnesota is our Minnesota name for AmeriCorps. AmeriCorps is what I call the Domestic Peace Corps. We have Peace Corps, and then we have AmeriCorps. Serve Minnesota does many things. They provide grants, and they get state and federal money. Some of the things, examples that I can share with you, they have programs to that work with Habitat for Humanity. They do tutoring through schools. They do volunteer service coordination. They do a lot of projects in communities that improve, do, you know, building projects, etc., do landscaping. There's just many things that Serve Minnesota does to improve the community. What Serve Minnesota is proposing to do, and we've had a wonderful pilot program going as part of their process or programs with Head Start, the Minnesota Literacy Council, and the St. Croix River Education District, and many of you that are members, I'll call you, I don't want to say old members, you're experienced members, have heard about the St. Croix River Education District and the impact that they've had on grades 1 through 5, and they've moved their process down to the early grades, and it's been so successful in the Head Start programs that Serve Minnesota wants to expand this in the literacy area to what they're calling a reading core. And so that is a proposal where they would start and create a age 3 to grade 3 kind of seamless system working in conjunction with early ed and then moving it into as a partnership with the K-12 system, but looking at consistently the early indicators and using them all the way through to make sure that the children are on target with their literacy goals. And so that is, it's not in your early childhood section. It's actually back in under another budget item because it's Serve Minnesota, and Serve Minnesota does many other things besides early literacy and childhood programs. But it is a wonderful program that we want to expand, and the evidence has been really very exciting when you look at the control group versus the students have been in this program. They're doing, the children are just doing very, very well. So that kind of gives you a summary, and certainly Ms. Carlson is here from our Early Childhood Division. If you've got detail questions about some of the implementation, we'll be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. That was I was going to ask you how you wanted to proceed with Ms. Carlson. I think we will just wait, get questions from the members, and then if any of them are more pertinent to Ms. Carlson, we'll let her jump in then. So, Representative Greiling, you had a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Commissioner Segrin, I know that you don't know all the details any more than I do, but as much as you do know, how is the governor's scholarship program different from the Senate allotment or allowance proposal?
Oh, Madam Chair, and Representative Growling, I don't have that information. I have not seen the detail of the Senate. Ms. Carlson may be able to tell you. I just haven't seen the proposal.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Freiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Segrin, I can ask Mr. Otis, too, who may know when he comes up. My question, my second last question then for you is when these scholarships are marketed, how are they marketed so that, you know, not, you know, we know that free and reduced lunch families have a variety of skills, and they could be the sort who do read to their kids. And the ones I think we're looking at as a target are probably the ones who do need the skills to be good parents, to make sure their kids are ready. So what are the plans? You know, it's my concern that by doing it this way rather than having it be universal, that we'll end up with the ones that need it the least rather than the ones that need it the most. So what is planned so far to cut into that fear?
Commissioner Segrin.
Madam Chair, I'll have Ms. Carlson answer.
Ms. Carlson, would you please identify yourself for the tape?
My name is Karen Carlson. I'm the Director of Early Learning Services for the Department of Education. And Madam Chair and Representative Grayling, we will be marketing a lot through our existing programs and through child care programs, so that hopefully the teachers and the staff in those programs will know those children and be able to help refer to the family. But let me back up a little bit about how the scholarship, the $7,000 and all, and the free and reduced lunch and everything was arrived at. As Commissioner Segrin told you, we do this kindergarten entrance assessment. We sample a representative sample of children in throughout the state. And what we found is approximately 10% of them are lagging in the areas of literacy and math. Now, we don't know the names of those children. The teachers in the classroom know the names of those children, the kindergarten teachers, but we don't. And so we don't, there's not a one-to-one correspondence, if you will, between the child who scores not yet ready in mathematical thinking to who may come in with the scholarship in their hand. That's who we're hoping to get to through our marketing, obviously. But you know, there, because we only do a representative sample, we just don't know those children, and you wouldn't want to know those children by name. So there's not a, you know, we're not handing those children the scholarship certificates. Now, what we have found in the assessment is that there are two major findings that these children come from families, one with low levels, their mothers have very low levels of education compared to the kids who are doing better at these measures, and two, they come from low household family household incomes. So the free and reduced lunch then is, if you will, used as the proxy to get to this population. So
Representative,
I don't know the best direct way, but
Commissioner Segrin.
Madam Chair, Representative Growling, you know, I think you've hit on an issue that is very, very important. I know even in enrolling students or children, our families in, you know, eligibility for health care has been a problem. We really are under-enrolled and have been struggling with how do you get that information out to parents so they actually enroll their children in eligible, you know, they're eligible right now for health care. One of the things that I, in a conversation with someone who is fairly well known around here, Roger Moe, we were talking about the Educational Cooperative Service Unit, and he had made a comment that they might be really able to facilitate some of that. You know, when you're starting to look at regions, you know, in the metropolitan area, you probably have a lot of communication resources, if you will, multiple resources of ways of reaching families. For example, even in our special ed area with our 0 to 3 students, our children, keep saying students, children, that we have to do some aggressive child find, you know, with children who might potentially be at risk. And we use, you know, doctors and other kinds of service areas. So I think that is something that we would be very aggressively pursuing, would be, you know, some multiple ways of and people that are contacting or having contact with people, and the educational service cooperatives may be a source too that we can explore. But we would certainly be very aggressive in working with our child care providers and Head Start and others to make sure that these families are receiving the scholarship.
Are you done? Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Segrin, on page 263, the governor's recommendations states that unless teachers hold a childhood licensure, they are not required to have training in these areas. Currently, school readiness, Head Start, and child care programs do not require teacher licensure. Could you just explain that for me?
Madam Chair and Representative Detmer, yes, the only mandate for early childhood teacher licensure in this state is for ECFE teachers to be licensed. So we have early childhood teachers in those other settings that you mentioned that don't carry early childhood licensure. The sort of the modules of child observation, what you see, how you interpret what you're seeing children exhibit, any kind of discussion about how you assess children based on what you see and what progress they're making based on your observations, and then thirdly, how you plan curriculum according to what kind of progress children are exhibiting. Those concentrated areas of training, if you will, are usually only a part of pre-service training. So at the higher ed levels, when teachers know they want to go into early childhood development or child development, they get that kind of concentrated emphasis. If you don't go that route, you usually don't get that kind of thing. You get some curriculum planning more based on sort of areas of development and what kind of activities fit and foster certain kinds of development. You certainly get that. But you don't get this concentrated look at really on what skills children are exhibiting and how to plan to improve that progress. And that's what we're finding with our teachers. When we go out and do assessments and kind of our own versions of in-service training on certain topics, that's what they tell us, that they don't have that background kind of to put all these other things onto, if you will.
Representative Lane.
Madam Chair. Let's see. I'm glad that we're moving lower and lower in age levels to look at beginning needs for education. But I don't think that we still recognize the biology behind it. And as we had an early childhood caucus yesterday, someone from the U of M describing the early brain development, the early brain development on which the literacy and math concepts are actually based is developing from birth on. And when it doesn't develop in those early, early years, I mean very early, we've lost them. It isn't a matter of, oh, we'll pick them up at age four and we'll work with licensed teachers and somehow we'll bring this together. We've lost the biology years before. And when we have 11-12% showing absolutely no indicators for literacy or math concepts pre-kindergarten, this is extremely serious, and this isn't just we have to work harder at this particular time. These particular families won't be applying. They just won't be applying. And as you've indicated, it's very difficult to find them or how do we get at them. Maybe the child care providers will help point us out to them, things like this. This won't happen. They're not there. When we're trying to break this cycle, and that's what it is, that this kind of it's not a matter just of education or lacking in education of the parents or lacking in money. It's lacking in life skills. It's a disorganized family. They're not going to be applying. We're looking at this whole thing through middle class glasses and expecting, well, if we just work in a middle class way to offer these opportunities, they'll come forth and we'll fix this problem. But they're not wearing those same glasses. So I'm wondering, well, let's see, I guess I'm just making some comments here. But I'm looking at perhaps actually approaching it at birth, at the hospital, at having someone go in to the hospital visit. And if it's an ordinary middle-class situation, providing parenting resources, possibilities, and also them being able to identify people that are at a very disorganized life. Some of them are homeless, even at that point. These children develop very, very, very serious problems within the first year or two of life. By the time we get them at age four, it's hard work to redeem it. We don't have the resources to even begin to redeem it. And we just need to break this cycle. That's the big thing that I'm seeing, is break this cycle. As we continue with the idea of no child left behind, as you know, the achievement gap continues, and everybody increases some. But the gap doesn't decrease, because we're still working with that same problem that started back here. We've got to get to the very, very beginning. So a second comment would be just early childhood, ECFE. That group really does work very well with middle class at all levels. To put the pressure on that to now try to solve this problem too is to destroy something that works very, very well at the level it does. We have... We don't have extended families anymore where parents can learn from their parents. So as ordinary, as I'm speaking of myself, for instance, go into parenting, we don't have the people to turn to for immediate day-to-day help around issues. So your early child for family education has provided that enormous service. I now have five children who are now all graduated from college. But when I think back to my early days with ECFE and then all the experiences through raising those kids, I know so much more then than I could ever dream of knowing back in the beginning. This program, ECFE, is wonderful. It can't solve this problem, though. It can't. And it shouldn't be expected to or be taken down because it doesn't have the plan on file of how it's going to solve this problem. Because we'll destroy something that works very well. And in fact, I would like to bring them in to help in, I think last year or whenever we expanded them to provide for ECFE services for daycare providers, or it would be like the grandparents or somebody besides the actual parent and child, because they're focused on parent and child coming together. And we expanded it so grandparents or other relatives could come in with the child. But I'm looking at see how we could provide for them to actually have a daycare provider bring an unlicensed daycare provider bring 2, 3, 4 kids with them and do a program and include them in the ECFE program, because that fits that kind of situation. But they cannot solve this difficult of having the 11 to 12% that have absolutely no indicators. Those children aren't there. Thank you. Commissioner Segrin?
Madam Chair and Representative Lane, perhaps I misspoke or maybe misunderstood about the ECFE program. There's no intent to tell them that they must not serve, you know, middle-class families. The intent is just to make sure that the mission that they are supposed to be doing is happening, and also that they're serving all families, that they reach out to all families and make sure that all families are included and incorporated. And that has been sort of a struggle I hear ECFE providers say that to me, frankly, too. So it's not to diminish what they're doing for all families. We actually last year did have a proposal to also allow daycare providers to come into ECFE. Your observation is very good. And the other thing, I don't think there's anyone in this room that doesn't disagree that we need to help those families that have very dysfunctional and serious problems with their children. It's not something that government really can solve either. You know, we can provide and intervene as fast as we can, but there are not always governmental solutions. Even as we craft governmental solutions, there's not always things that we can do. As I alluded to you, with our special education child find, actually, we are now directed as a department to actually very aggressively include in our child find counts now those children who have the potential of being at risk. And there is some broad definition where we have to work with hospitals, doctors, et cetera, and other providers who, let's say, for an example, a child is born of a drug-addicted mother. Now, this baby may have no signs of any kind of drug addiction or anything, but if there is a history there that someone is aware of, we are supposed to very actively connect with that family and make sure that that child is assessed if there is any concern. So we're actually now, you know, having to do some of those things and being told to do that through our early childhood programs or our interventions in special education. You know, certainly brain development is very important, and I agree with you on that. And, you know, there... But I'm not going to write off a child at 4 years of age and say that there's no hope for that child. We have to, you know, continue to work with those children, and children are strong and resilient, and hopefully we can intervene and do the things that we should be doing for those children. And I, you know, I have the same concerns, I think, as all of us do, for those very dysfunctional families that whose children, you know, be harmed forever because of lack of support, etc.
Thank you, Commissioner Segrin. And Representative Lane, I appreciate you letting us listen in on that conversation. That was a very valuable conversation. Thank you. Representative Gottwall.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Commissioner, if I could, a couple of questions and then a comment. What percentage of our kids, since we're talking about the ultimate goal of having kids ready for K, getting them ready to go into elementary school, what percentage right now are being assessed as ready for K?
Well,
I'm kind of working off of page 264
yeah, okay.
Here.
Representative Gottwall, and I'll let Ms. Carlson, she deals with the assessment process more intimately than I do, but what we're seeing is that about 10 to 12% of our students or children consistently are not ready. There are levels of in this kindergarten assessment that are looked at, and the levels are, you know, you're ready, and there's an in-process level. Here we go. Yeah, you have a not yet in-process and proficient. And so we know that when you combine the in-process and the proficient, you've got about, you know, 80% to 90% of the students are who are in some process. And, of course, even in the in process, you may have some at the lower range and then some that are almost, you know, completely ready. So you've got that developmental range. So what the governor chose to focus on was that 10 to 12%. And then when you even break down the subject, the areas where they're assessed, and that would be in physical development, in personal and social development, language literacy, and mathematical literacy, for the most part, the areas where the students are really struggling is in literacy and mathematics. The other areas, the majority of our children are in process or are proficient. So it's, you know, and you don't want to start, you know, I really hesitate, you know, even when you're looking at social and emotional development, you know, and, you know, indicator of, you know, can a child sit still? Well, you know, my little four-year-old grandson is a bundle of energy, and he's very bright, and, you know, he basically will learn something pretty quickly and then move on, and, you know, once he's moved on, he's jumping on the chairs or, you know, doing some other things or, you know, as little boys will want to do, climbing things. But, you know, so that's where I think we always have to kind of make sure we're not just all of a sudden saying, well, this little child can sit still for an hour. And, you know, so you have to kind of take this all with, you know, what a little child is. But, you know, there will always be some, and then those are the children that you, you know, certainly would want to, you know, be cognizant of that, you know, maybe do have a number of indicators that would indicate some concern, and then you'd want to intervene with those children.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Madam Vice Chair?
Yes.
Commissioner Segrin, excellent point. I think that's important for us to recognize 80 to 90% are ready for K. And your second point about intervening too early and labeling people too early and assessing them as being problem kids or at-risk kids too early. I have a three-year-old myself and have four kids above that, and I've watched all of them go through those stages of early childhood. And I have a great concern about what our other representative was talking about with going right into the cradle and reaching in. Parents are the first teachers, and families are the first environment that kids learn, and we know that. And we need to be partners with parents and families, not replacing them, not reaching in and telling them what to do. So I think that's very important. Could you talk a little bit about the importance? Is there a measurable impact of parental engagement on this ready for K factor? A lot of what I see with parental language in the proposals we've been seeing, both from the state, from the department, and from other organizations, has to do with telling parents how to be parents. But what about that piece of parental engagement?
I'll let Ms. Carlson maybe answer some of those questions. I know ECFE is really, I think, a wonderful model of not telling parents what to do, but helping parents, have the skills to, be parents. I think you have a good point, coming alongside parents, where we're hoping that all of these things are not intrusive, that they're not governmental things where the government is taking over being the parent, because I think there isn't anyone here in this room that does not believe that the parent should be the prime, provider and caregiver of their children. And I think as Representative Lane talked about, she was alluding to some parents that just are families that are so dysfunctional that we need to support them in, serious ways. Ms. Carlson, you may have some other...
Commissioner, I am afraid that we are out of time. If we don't wrap up now, the next presenters are going to be sorely underserved. This is so unfortunate. This conversation has really gotten just good right now. And Representative Sawyer.
When there was severe hearing about the readiness assessment in early childhood, they're at 4 o'clock. So if anybody's interested in a further, that's specifically what has been rezoned. So you just want to let me know that.
Also, excellent.
Representative Gottwald is going to be heading up a working group on parental involvement in early childhood. So we're taking a look at that.
Thank you, Representative. Would you know the room number offhand?
We're
200 today at
4 o'clock.
So members interested in continuing this conversation, please attend. But we need to move on. Commissioner and Ms. Carlson, thank you very much. Now I would like to call Todd Otis, President of Ready for K, and Zoe Nicoli. Is it Zoe or Zoe?
Oh.
Zoe Nicoli. That was supposed to be on my list of things to do this morning before I started this, was to find out the pronunciation of your name.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning, Mr. Otis. Would you go ahead and proceed?
My name is Todd Otis. I'm president of Ready for K. I love coming to the House because I served here 12 years, and... I guess I wanted to start by saying in that service, I chaired the Economic Development Committee and felt that the dollars we spend on education are the most important economic development dollars we spend in the state. This is the most important issue in the state, in my opinion. And it's so exciting to have the K-12 committee, E-12 committee, looking at it as a common issue. Representative Greiling had a hearing where we had a chance to testify briefly, too. But if we did nothing else but make the linkage in the mind of the public and of the policymakers here that this is early education, we would have succeeded. Because once we start talking about education in Minnesota, people's expectations and standards change. Education is probably the most important value we have. When you go door knocking, it's about education, if you really care about the future of the state. So let me just briefly tell you who we are, what we're trying to do, What we think the best way to go is, and I know we don't have a lot of time, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan group. Our whole mission is to try to get our children ready for kindergarten. The organizing concept of Ready for K is school readiness. So we believe when we say that 50% of our kids are not fully prepared, we're going on the basis of the MDE study that basically was based on kindergarten teachers' assessments of entering kindergartners. They're trained to do this, and based on their observations, they put children in a category of either not yet, in process, or proficient. Well, not half the kids are proficient. So when we say 50% of our kids are not fully prepared, that's the basis. And we want every child ready, every child to be in that proficient column. So that's our mission as an organization. And we think that there are many strategies to do that. Maybe I could try to, we're going to go through a PowerPoint with Zoe, and you'll hear a lot of what we're about. On the issue of the difference between the House and the Senate's version of the bill and the allowances versus other ways of doing it, just a couple of comments. The main point is to give parents good choices and give them the resources to have good choices in quality settings. We are really comfortable with and appreciative of Representative Slawik's leadership on this and her approach. We believe you need a combination of giving resources and information to parents and providing the infrastructure in terms of program support so that those resources can be well used. In my view, Representative Slawik's approach of doing both is really critically important for serving our children well. Just technically, the governor's proposal serves only 4-year-olds. The Senate version does 3- and 4-year-olds. The Senate version is more kind of a sliding fee, so it would serve more children. We don't know how many resources are involved, but hopefully a lot will be so that a lot of families can be served that way. We're viewing this as a work in progress. And ultimately, at the end of the session, at the end of the day, we're hoping that we will have empowered parents to have more resources, more knowledge, more ability to get a quality experience for their kids. And we hope to be a resource for you as you think through how to do that. Let me just go through our four main principles and then hand it off to Zoe, because I'm feeling the press of time. Number one is support parents. Absolutely central to the whole thing is families and parents. So we want to empower parents with information and give them the resources to make good choices. But parents are at the core of this. And when we start to, as Ready for K, stray away from that, one of our board members hammers us on and says, it's about parents, and that's Al Cui. Whenever we think it can all be done by programs or start to move in that direction, parents are at the center of this. But we want to give them the resources to do the job. Promote quality is the second principle. That is so important in this field. We just can't plunk our kids down in front of TVs and hope for the best. We've got to have active interchange with those little kids in the formative years, and quality child care providers and other early educators are critical. Increase access. This shouldn't be the type of thing that if you have enough money, you can get what you need, but for the rest of you, just hope for the best. We really should not leave any child behind in this world. And access is important, and it frankly costs money. But it's probably the best money we can spend, as you've heard from Art Rolnick of the Federal Reserve. Then final point, produce results. Let's be accountable. Are we moving the needle on school readiness? Are our policies actually moving us from 50 to 80% of the kids ready for K, which is our goal and that of the United Way and other groups by 2012? So with that, maybe if I could hand it off to Zoe to walk through the PowerPoint and our policy agenda a bit and then answer questions, we'd be happy to.
That would be perfect. Would you proceed and please identify yourself for the tape?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Zoe Nicolai, Director of Public Policy with Ready for K. And I do want to just alert you to a packet that, and you should have a copy of the PowerPoint, but also a packet of information. We're not going to take the time to go through this, but we think there's some very useful background research and some information on the early care and education in Minnesota in this packet.
Thank you.
So, get Minnesota ready for K. Children can't wait to learn. If we could, what we want to do is bring this message to you, to the governor, from the children of Minnesota. We are born learning. When you support our parents, when you give them the resources they need to access quality early care, when you build program capacity in our communities, we will be ready for kindergarten and we'll be ready for success in life. I'm going to go over stuff that's probably not news to all of you, but it's always, I think, a very good reminder to talk about the critical importance of these years 0 to 5 as being learning years, as a time when the human brain is developing more quickly than it will at any other time in a child's life. The first 5 years are a time of enormous social, emotional, physical, cognitive growth. You notice that kind of mirrors the five domains that get measured when they get to kindergarten. A child's ability to be attentive and focused and follow directions happens early on in life. And we know the research is very clear that when kids have quality experiences, whether at home with mom or with friends and neighbors or in more formal settings, that it does foster their success in school and in life. I was just at a conference in D.C. and had the pleasure to once again hear Dr. Jack Shonkoff. Many of you may be familiar with his work. He's a scientist. He edited the Neurons to Neighborhood. His goal in life is to talk to state governments and to policymakers about the role of science in really understanding the brain, the development in the brain, and the critical importance of what that means for children's development. And the thing that really hit me about his presentation this time, and I took a couple of slides from his presentation, was really talking about how actually the brain develops. These brain circuits, they're built in a bottom-up sequence. They stabilize over time. It makes it much more difficult to be altered after those windows of opportunity after age 5. The window of opportunity for adaptive development does remain open for many years, but the cost of remediation grows with age. So it's much more efficient, both biologically and economically. Let's get things right the first time than to try to fix them later. And he goes on to say that quality interventions really do make a difference, particularly for our most vulnerable at-risk children. That when we are thoughtful and planful about putting in place an array of supports and services for parents, that we can see positive impacts on brain development that generate a significant return. To do that, though, it does have to be quality programs. You need to have good, low staff turnover, well-trained personnel with expertise, culturally competent, that matches the needs of the children. And as you'll see as we go through this, this is really what Ready for K is trying to do with the agenda that we're bringing to you. The research is also clear that when you focus on the most at-risk children, you get the highest return on the investment. It is children from low-income families who show the greatest magnitude of benefits when they're given the opportunity to participate in high-quality early care and education settings. It's clear that this is a strategy that can really help address the achievement gap. In Minnesota, we have a large gap. I don't need to really talk to you about it. It's on everyone's minds. How can we do a better job at closing this gap between minority and disadvantaged students and their white counterparts? Minnesota's not unique across the country. Educators and policymakers are looking to early childhood as one of those key strategies for being able to close the achievement gap. So I'm not going to spend too much time because Todd has referred to this. We say the children aren't doing so well, certainly not as well as we could hope, in terms of making sure that when kids come to school, we have more than half of them fully proficient. Here are the domains that were referenced, and I won't spend too much time on that. Again, I want to focus on
Our policy agenda, we really, in the best of all worlds, we really probably would be going for a universal system where all parents get some kind of help. We know that with limited resources, we can't afford to do that. And so our policy agenda is focused primarily on making sure that kids most at risk are, and families are going to get the supports they need. The data shows that the gap between children in low-income families' reading comprehension is more than 40 points. I was trying to look up this, and I couldn't remember exactly, but it's something like a child, a middle-class child entering, I think, either kindergarten or third grade, I can't remember which one, 12,000 words, a child from low income, 4,000 words. It's just huge gaps in what kids bring as they enter kindergarten. Far fewer literacy and language experiences. Low-income families, little access for a rich array of books and materials for their families. We really believe that Minnesota can and must do better. Currently, Minnesota spends about $147 million in those state dollars for early care and education. That's less than 1% of the state's budget. When I looked at the increase in the governor's budget to 34.4, and his increase, we still remain, of his increase of about $38 million, we still remain at less than 1% of the state budget. And this is at a time when we know at least 75% of the brain is developing, but that a child will have experienced less than 5% when you put together state and federal and other public investments by the time they're age 23. This is a graph that I find really startling when you look at the purple line and the brain development in those first 5 years, and you see the blue line below. That's our public investment in our kids at up to age five, and that just needs to get reversed. It's really all that we know with a return on investment. We're really not wisely using our resources. Too many families don't have access to programs that could help them. One in five MFIP families receive child care assistance. One in eight families eligible for basic SLIDIC fee. Head Start is serving half of the children who are eligible, 0 to 5. ECFE, less than half. School readiness programs in the public schools, less than a third. And only 15% of our child care centers are accredited. It's especially important that we be thinking, and Todd mentioned one of our key principles is to increase quality wherever children are. And we have, Minnesota's one of the states with the highest percentage of mothers in the workforce. We know child care access issues interfere with low-income parents getting and keeping full-time work. We believe that we need child care assistance, those cuts to be restored, but we strongly believe that that program needs to become a two-purpose program, one that not only helps parents get to work, but helps those children get ready for school. Families with incomes below $20,000, they're paying the highest percentage for child care, 28%. So Todd spoke a little bit. This is Ready for K's vision that 100% of kids enter kindergarten fully prepared. Todd talked about our goal of moving towards, by 2012, 80% of kids being prepared. To do that, if you look at that half of the circle on the left, there's a large number of in-process kids, and I agree with the commissioner that I think many of those kids are going to be, by the time they leave kindergarten, they're going to be probably have caught up. If you look at how many kids are not reading by the end of third grade, it's clear that it's not just 10%. There's many more that need additional help, and we need to go beyond that in-process category if we're going to be serious about raising the needle on school readiness. Todd talked about our guiding principles. I won't go through those. I want to just very quickly go. We have a in your packet, there's a the cover page is a green sheet, which Todd, you must have pulled out. There it is. This is our policy agenda. We've got six key strategies. And together, we believe that they move Minnesota towards a coordinated, effective early childhood system that works. I'm going to just run through these very quickly. One of our bills, support parents, education begins at home. Excuse me just a minute while I catch up on my own PowerPoint. We've got Representative Lane is carrying part of this bill, and Representative Bly is carrying the ECFE parent ed part. There'll be a couple of bills. We want to restore ECFE back to 120. We also want to create a new parent education grant program that will be really a responsive, flexible program that would give other groups that are working with immigrant communities, with teen moms, with very low-income communities that have a very cultural interface with the families that they serve, that there should be an opportunity. There's some very good programs out there. Steve Mel, the Parents of Teachers models. And let's give some other groups an opportunity to say, I'm going to serve these most at risk. Keep it targeted to the most at risk, and it's a small grant program for that. Then Representative Lane alluded to this, the need to really be doing a better job of greeting every parent, every baby that comes into, that is born in Minnesota with hello, welcome, here's a packet of information, not just the website. I think that the website that the governor is promoting, the parents, his Educate Parents, is one piece of information, but many families do not directly go to a website when their child is born. And instead to have a human face there greeting them, we have many communities that are already doing this, but let's make it systemic. Let's make sure that we have a plan for how ECFE home visitors, public health nurses, Head Start, there's an array of people we can bring together to plan for greeting that family. And then all families can benefit from that, but then there are a far fewer number of families, but families with a great number of needs, whether they're homeless, whether it's abuse, fleeing from abuse, whether they may be at risk of maltreatment and abuse of their children. A small group of families, the research is clear, and Jack Shakoff, Shankoff talked about this beautifully, that when you provide them with some targeted intensive home visiting with trained mentors, and you do that with a multidisciplinary team, we build on what we have in Minnesota. So the public health nurse starts off with a family, but then you may bring in an ECFE home visitor, or you may bring in someone from social services. You are helping that family. These are the kids who are the most at risk, who we are going to lose. They will definitely be in that 10% not yet ready, and they will cost Minnesota a lot of money down the road if we don't intervene early on and help them be successful in life. Then early screening, we also are supporting a bill that would just increase the screening, the reimbursements for screening. Quality early learning choices for parents is, we're very happy that Representative Slawik has agreed to carry this bill. As Todd said, there's going to be a lot of conversation about how we work with the governor's proposal, which we were excited to see, the Senate proposal, which we're very excited to hear that they're talking about significant investments. But we are concerned that you cannot just, especially in greater Minnesota, throw open, expect the market to respond when there's basically almost no market to respond. In greater Minnesota, we need to be sure that we're helping build the capacity, build program capacity, so when parents get their certificate, when they get an allowance, there's some place for them to go that meets the quality standards. So we think there needs to be this blended support of increasing some spaces for Head Start, for school readiness, for child care, but requiring they meet common standards of quality and how they're going to be measuring children's progress. And then when parents get that information, they clearly are going to have good choices to make.
Excuse me, Ms. Nicolai, I'm so sorry, but we need to move forward. And there are two people who were going to ask questions on the earlier presentation, and so I want to make sure that they get their questions answered. And we have a couple of new ones, and I think that is just so valuable, is the interaction.
Absolutely.
And so if you don't mind, members, go ahead and take a look at the slides that we were not able to cover. And if you have any questions about those slides, you can ask specific questions. But I would like to go to Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Oda, Ms. Nicolai, I didn't have an opportunity to interact with Commissioner Seidman before. We all ought to have an extra 4 hours a day at this, I think. But first of all, I'd like to second Representative Lane's comments. I believe that ideology should take second place to scientific fact. We should base our proposals, our government programs, on fact, on the reality on the ground. So that's number one. Secondly, the governor's proposal impacts approximately 10 to 12%. In all the literature I've been reading, and that in the newspapers and elsewhere, the number I keep hearing is 50%. Now, if it's close to 50%, then the proposals being made by the administration are woefully inadequate. So before we go any further, I would like to have a clarification on which of these numbers is the realistic number. Is it 10%? Is it 50% of children unprepared to learn and to enter kindergarten?
Mr. Otis.
Yeah, I would welcome you to look at the report from which we're making those statements. That's the Department of Education School Readiness Assessment. Basically, we're saying that we would want every child in that third column, the proficient column. And again, it's based on trained kindergarten teachers' observations of what children know and can do. So we think it's a fair statement that 50% of our children are not fully prepared for kindergarten. Commissioner Segrin is right. Every child is different. So when we say that, it doesn't mean that we think the other 50% who aren't where we want them to be will all have lives of abject failure and misery, but our odds of long-term success as a state are much better when that proficient column goes from 50 to 80%. So it's not black or white for any one child, but we think it's intellectually responsible and fair to say that when fewer than half our kids are fully prepared for K, we ought to go to 80%, and the returns on investment are higher for the most at-risk kids, too. Going back to your statement about basing our policy on reason and logic and research, Art Rolnick of the Federal Reserve has made really compelling cases, but that is where we get a big return. So I understand the focus on the at-risk kids, particularly as there's a correlation between low income and at-risk. But we think every child ultimately ought to be viewed in that picture of being ready for K. And it isn't all just low-income kids that have a problem. So I think by having a larger commitment, and it's going to cost money, It's going to be an investment, and it will pay, and these studies have shown that. But it isn't going to be done on the cheap. And so to some extent, this legislature and this governor have to ask themselves, how many kids do we really want to have an impact on? How fast do we want to move the needle from 50% to 80%? We're really hoping that this legislature and this governor this year will say we really want to get going fast.
Thank you, Mr. Otis. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for Mr. Otis. Yes. My question is, going off of what Representative Blaine had to say about targeting parents, the one question and one concern I have is I know a lot of parents in my district do not have access to computers. They don't have a computer at home, so a website is not going to help them, especially our low-income families. So when we talk about the resources of being able to target them, do we currently have resources in place in the state of Minnesota where we do track our newborn infants? I mean, I know when they leave the hospital, they're given a plethora of information, the parents are, when they leave, about different screenings and tests that their children can go through. But do we follow up later on with their immunizations and other requirements that we have or other resources that we want the parents and children to have? Do we have something in place that we can target these parents and track the children where they are from birth to age 2 or 3 so that we can get them information and resources later on?
Mr. Otis, before you respond, may I just ask everybody to please try to be prepared with your questions, and let's try to take about 1 minute with question and answer. I'd like to get to all the questions. Thank you, Mr. Otis.
It really varies from county to county. There are counties that have a program called Follow Along where they really do a very aggressive effort to keep in touch with those families and follow along with them through those key years. I don't know in your county whether that's there. I know that, for example, in Mankato, I think every child is greeted with the kind of information we talked about for our bill, But it does vary from state to state, and we're hoping we can get into a more statewide system where it's universal.
Excellent. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will try to take just a minute.
Less than 1 minute. 1 minute, including answer.
Representative Wayne talked about 003, and I hope that we look at that seriously as we go through all of our education committees. If your child is in the 10, I don't care if we're talking 10% that aren't ready or 50% that aren't ready. And I ask the members in the audience, if your child is in that 10 or 50%, is that acceptable? It's not acceptable. If it's 10%, and I'm so happy to hear ready for K is saying, let's get 100% of kids ready. And just a statistic that I read recently, if the students who dropped out of class, the class of 2006 had graduated, that would have benefited our national economy by $300 billion, not only resource-wise, but also internally and personally-wise. So I hope we don't spend time talking about percents, because every child needs to be ready. And then I want to just end by saying the Education Committee had the opportunity to go to a early childhood center this week and witness E12 linkages with the St. Paul School and this early childhood to make a better transition to for those children into the public school system. And it was a refreshing and successful cooperative effort coming from a member who has been here, spent 33 years in a secondary building, now sees the importance of birth through five. So I just wanted to add that E12 linkage is also very important.
Thank you. And I think I apologize, but we need to go on to the next presenter. And Representative Slawick, Mr. Otis, would you go ahead, please? Did you have something you wanted to add? Representative Slawick.
We will see right today, at least in our committee, many, many times over in the buildings of testifying. And they're available as a great resource to all of you, and I encourage you to meet them. But this is sort of opening the door on the conversation that we'll continue to have.
Thank you very much. And now I would call on Dr. Karen Ephraim she is a policy analyst and board member for EdWatch.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm a mother of three, a pediatrician, and a policy analyst with EdWatch and three other national organizations. I want to let you know that we really appreciate your concern for children, especially disadvantaged ones. But what I'd like to do is, this morning in my brief time, is to make you aware of some other information regarding early childhood programs and some of the potential unintended consequences of the zeal to do good. A frequent justification for preschool programs that you often hear is brain research, and we've heard a lot of that today. Jack Schoenkopf was specifically mentioned. But I find it interesting that one of his other quotes from the Neurons to Neighborhood studies is rarely ever mentioned, and that's this one. Quote, assertions that the die has been cast by the time the child enters school are not supported by neuroscience evidence and can create unwarranted pessimism about the potential efficacy of interventions that are initiated beyond the preschool years, end quote. Proponents of early and universal preschool tell us that 50% of the kindergartners are not ready to learn, and that was just the big debate that you've had. But not only do we have to talk about the percentages, but we also have to talk about the quality of the assessment and the standards or outcomes upon which it's based. For instance, we have very large concerns about how valid and reliable these questions and these standards are. In the what's supposed to be an objective academic area like reading, there is an item on the assessment, for instance, that says gains meaning
by listening. Now, how do you actively, accurately, objectively, or fairly assess that in a child that is rapidly developing or changing? When you get into the socio-emotional area, it's even more controversial. There is an item that says, shows eagerness and curiosity as a learner. Now, that might be nice, but how do you use those kinds of items to say then that 50% of Minnesota children are not ready to learn? Basically, you can't. And to use that kind of data to promote programs may not be serving children well. Multiple experts and groups such as the World Health Organization and the National Center for Infant and Early Childhood Health Policy admit the difficulty of accurately assessing young children, especially in the socio-emotional area. And why do I bring this up? First of all, poor and minority children, according to federal data, are over-identified for special education, particularly in the emotional behavioral realm and the mental retardation realm. If you use this kind of kindergarten readiness assessment with its vague and subjective criteria, you are potentially over-labeling and unfairly labeling especially poor and minority children. And we question whether that's a good thing to do. We don't want to be falsely labeling children as academic or emotional failures at the beginning of their careers, especially when they change and develop so rapidly. Secondly, many older studies, as well as a November 2005 study, indicate academic and emotional harm resulting for significant numbers of children in preschool programs. The 2005 study from UC Berkeley, which is hardly a conservative institution, said in part, quote, attendance in preschool centers, even for short periods of time each week, hinders the rate at which young children develop social skills and display the motivation to engage classroom tasks reported by their kindergarten teachers. This applied to children who spent more than 6 hours per day in these programs, and the effect worsened with higher socioeconomic status. Third, according to the President's Commission on Special Education, 90% of children served have high incidence disorders like learning disabilities, emotional disturbances, and ADD. 90% of those are related to reading problems. So that is the kind of thing that we really should be focusing on. And you've heard much about studies that are supposed to justify the expansion of early childhood programs, programs like Perry Preschool, Chicago, and Abecedarian. Yet you rarely hear that all of these studies have significant methodological flaws, small sample sizes, are very expensive, have not been replicated, are very difficult to take on a large scale, and either don't have the impacts advertised or the positive results are related more to parental influence or involvement than actual participation in the program. I can give you details, and I will pass out quotes to buttress what I'm saying in a moment. No preschool program has shown academic benefit beyond the third grade. Georgia has spent over $1 billion in 10 years and seen no improvement in test scores. Oklahoma has also had universal pre-K for several years and has lost ground in the National Assessment of Educational Progress reading scores for fourth graders when the evidence of benefit of preschool would be the most apparent. The same is true in international comparisons of reading, math, and science. U.S. fourth graders, when the benefits of preschool would be most apparent, outscored their universally preschool peers in places like Italy, France, Germany, Sweden. It's not until the 8th and 12th grade that they fall to the middle and then the bottom, respectively, of the academic heap. that indicates more problems in K-12 than it does to a lack of preschool.
Ms. Ephraim, I do apologize. I'm going to need to end this testimony because we are over our time and we are headed for session in a few short minutes. Please know that it would be the chair's expectation that as we hear these bills coming through here, that we'll advise you of that and afford you an opportunity to continue. And thank you for sharing
some
provocative thoughts with us this morning. Members, we are then adjourned until next week.